In the U.S., more than 40% of adults with very low literacy live in poverty.
Doctors will give me medicines. I almost died because I didn't know how to read the labels on it.
One in five Americans read below the level needed to earn a living wage.
Probably going to end up working at a car wash or picking up garbage. I mean, really, without being able to read, what are you qualified to do?
A mother's reading level is the greatest determinant of her child's academic future.
I work in a bank, and we get customers that say that they can't read, and that's a complication because we can't fill out legal documents for people.
I'm Jen White of Michigan Radio, and this is Front and Center, a project that takes an in-depth look at an issue affecting the Great Lakes region. This time, we're peeling back the layers of low literacy. Over the next hour, we'll explore the impacts that illiteracy has on our communities and what literacy in an ever-changing digital world will really mean in our future. Literacy is a big issue of concern for our educational system. Illiteracy can prevent people from filling out a job application or earning a living wage. It also affects your civic participation. Dr. Timothy Shanahan is chair of the National Early Literacy Panel, and Catherine Snow is a professor at Harvard in the Graduate School of Education. Welcome to you both.
Hi, happy to be here.
We've been asking people about literacy, and we had a chance to talk with Nathaniel from Toledo about the role of literacy in his life.
We have to know how to read, basically. You know, if we can't read, then it's just like you're at a standstill. If you don't comprehend, you know, basically what's in front of you or anything around you, then it could be like you're foreign.
When we talk about illiteracy, is it just the inability to read, or is the definition more expansive now?
I think for a lot of people, they think of illiteracy as somebody who can't read at all or who, you know, perhaps can't sign their name, that type of thing. In the United States, most adults who are, you know, would get classified as illiterate, they have some literacy. They can usually read simple messages. They can usually do things like sign their name and so on. But there are a whole range of things that they struggle with, you know, more complex messages. So, you know, reading, it's not just about sort of producing the words that are in text. You really have to be able to understand that information and use it, whether that's, you know, economically or to take care of your health or you know, anything else.
Professor Snow, is this an issue that we see concentrated in certain regions, or are illiteracy rates pretty consistent across the nation?
Illiteracy rates are absolutely not consistent across the nation, and that's the big challenge for the country. And it's much more likely to be characteristic of students who are attending or who have graduated from poorly resourced schools, from schools in urban areas, people who come from backgrounds where there's not a high level of literacy in the home.
Poor communities, urban communities, they don't exist in a bubble. How do these high illiteracy rates start to bleed out into surrounding communities and affect them as well?
When we talk about communities and neighborhoods and such, the language is usually very static about it, but the reality is there's a lot of movement of people, whether that's you know, an economic set of moves or you know, people chasing, you know, good schools or whatever. But there's a huge amount of movement.
A person who is illiterate or low literate can have trouble communicating. Lori from Toledo says that challenge can spill over into the community as well.
Oh, I think it's a big problem for the community because those people who need the resources the most in terms of help for, say, food or housing or whatever it might be, don't know how to get it because they can't read.
Professor Snow, how do we see low literacy limiting people's ability to access resources?
If you think about how you get information in the course of a day, most of that information comes in through reading. Think of the piles of mail that arrive at your door every day. Now, if you have very high literacy skills, you can sort through, throw most of it out, and keep the one or two things that you know are important and process those. But if you have very low literacy skills, it can take a great deal of time just to figure out what you should be reading and what you shouldn't be reading, what you should be working through and what you can ignore. The world that we live in is a very literate world, and not having literacy skills just simply cuts you off from the way things are done, the way information is transmitted, the way resources are made available.
As we've been talking to people, we're hearing stories of how illiteracy and low literacy can really affect people's quality of life. Brandy from Toledo says she's seen the effect of illiteracy in her community.
For a lot of people that don't know how to read, it's harder to live. Some of them end up homeless. I know three people who've ended up homeless just because they couldn't read.
So do we see a link between homelessness and illiteracy? Dr. Shanahan?
Yes, there is a link between homelessness and illiteracy or low literacy. One of the things that happens if you're low in literacy is you have more difficulty getting a job, keeping a job. If you do have a job, the pay levels tend to be a lot lower. And obviously one of the reasons why people end up in a homeless state is because of poverty. When we work with folks in homeless shelters and so on, we find a much greater incidence of low literacy than you would see in the general population.
So two ideas. One is that for the individual, there is an impact when someone is illiterate. They can't access the resources. They may end up homeless. But then there's also this larger impact on the community because they can't function fully and they have to rely on other people. How impactful is illiteracy for a community when you have high concentrations?
Well, literacy really reverberates through all aspects of life. And so look at employment kinds of issues. What you find is that employers are currently spending in between $50 and $100 billion a year in basic education for their workers, essentially training costs that are falling on the economic system, which is money that can't be paid out in wages, that doesn't come back to the community in terms of investments and so on. And so it really costs us jobs. There's another piece of it that's really tied up in things like health care. We, for example, had been doing some work in the VA hospital, the Veterans Administration Hospital here in Chicago, and are finding that, in fact, for a number of men, if they're low in literacy and don't have a lot of other social resources, essentially that combination results in greater numbers of hospitalizations that go on longer than they need to, injury and death in terms of treatments that aren't followed or that are followed incorrectly.
What's at stake for the U.S. here when we look at this issue in the larger global context?
Well, we're certainly at risk of losing jobs. Another thing we're losing, though, citizenship. We're losing democracy because in a complex world where politicians ought to be making complex arguments, they don't. And the reason they don't is because people don't understand complex arguments. So the political discourse has declined to a very low level.
Dr. Shanahan, your thoughts?
One of the things that happens in a society like ours, if you're low in literacy, that tends to isolate you. That tends to break you off from the community. And so being low in literacy carries a bit of a shame factor. It leads people to sort of self-isolate. They pull back, and your community is less strong when that happens.
Is there something that can be done to shift that stigma, to move it away from being something shameful and encourage people to reach out for help?
I think it's a complex problem. I don't think we really do know how to reduce the shame value. I don't think making things difficult or challenging or hard to access, we need to do everything we can to sort of reduce those demands when they're not necessary.
Dr. Shanahan, where do you think the disconnect is? Why haven't we bridged that gap between the kind of basic literacy that Professor Snow is talking about to this larger approach to comprehension?
Well, I think we're often prisoners of our ideology. And so certainly, part of our public ideology is we've developed over the years this belief that literacy is really just knowing letters and writing your name and things like that. I think another ideological prison that we find ourselves in is our beliefs in equality, our beliefs that everyone should be treated the same. And so, for example, in terms of our funding of schools and education, the states tend to put out money very equal basis for each community, and then each individual neighborhood can raise its taxes a bit to improve the lot of their children. But what that has meant is that the children who come to school with the greatest needs really don't have the sufficient resources to do what's necessary. And so what we see are things like, two sets of schools with equal funds, one school perhaps being very attractive to work in, another one not so attractive, and they have the same amount of money available to chase down teachers that they would like to hire. Well, the way that actually plays out is, they both got to hire teachers, but you're more likely to have a certified teacher, you're more likely to have a teacher who's highly skilled in a well-to-do area than you will in a poverty area. And so what looks equal really turns out to be insufficient to really meet the needs of the parts of our population that are struggling the most.
I've been speaking with Timothy Shanahan, chair of the National Early Literacy Panel, and Catherine Snow, a professor at Harvard in the Graduate School of Education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that generally the most important things that I've read have been letters. I still have a letter that I wrote to my grandmother, who's now dead, as an adult, reading something that I wrote when I was about 10 years old, really expressed emotions that I was feeling and was that able to express them. It just kind of triggered a chain of thought at how capable we are as little children of not just having emotions, but really expressing them and the degree of complexity that we have. And it's easy to forget that as an adult.
Still to come, we'll travel to New York, where we'll meet a group of immigrants learning English.
You know, we're not looking for people to quote Shakespeare. We're looking for people to know what the difference is between hot and cold and slow down, go faster. I mean, very basic life skills and employment skills.
Literacy as a key to economic success. That story coming up in 15 minutes on Front and Center from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is Front and Center. I'm Jen White.
Name is Joe Wesley Cooper. I'm 54. I remember kids making fun of me, laughing because I couldn't read and write. And as time went on, they would just send me to another grade. And I go through the same thing. Why couldn't you spell my middle name, Wesley? I was afraid of someone asking me how to spell Wesley because I didn't know how. I couldn't even pronounce my ABCs at that time. I used to go to school and I would just sit there. Then I got in the Job Corps, found out in the Job Corps that I couldn't read, pushed back to a corner. Went in the National Guard, they found out I couldn't read, pushed back to a corner. Went in the Army, pushed back to a corner. So all my life I was just pushed back and forth, pushed back and forth. I did not want to be a statistic. I wanted to be independent where I could take care of myself, to hold a job, to get a car, to be married. All the things that I dreamed of watching everybody else do, reading, writing, writing letters, writing books, writing songs, I had all these dreams, and I didn't have any idea where I was going. There's a big world out here, and I wanted to be a part of this world.
That was Joe Wesley Cooper. We spoke to him in Indianapolis.
There is a lot of shame attached to not being able to read for someone who was born here in the United States. And a lot of people, this is their big secret in life. It may even be a secret from their spouse or from their children that they're trying to hide, and especially from their employer.
Angela Steele is the director of the Adult Tutoring Program at the Literacy Center of West Michigan. Angela, what brings people to your door? What makes them finally want to seek help?
Everyone that we serve is an adult over the age of 18, and everyone that we serve is currently reading below a ninth grade reading level.
Many of them already have a high school diploma, which is surprising to some people, but they're facing many challenges in life. It's not just not being able to read a novel. Everything that they're attempting to do, literacy is getting in their way. Their jobs are changing. They're being asked to read more, do more computer work. So they're really feeling stuck without that reading, writing, speaking, listening, and they feel like they can't move forward without some help.
What challenges do you as a provider face when you're trying to help people improve their literacy skills?
When you're serving adults and you're looking for adults that have time to work on their literacy, a lot of them will have 1, 2, 3 part-time jobs, children, and when it comes down to priorities and where they're going to spend their time, are they going to put food on the table this week or are they going to go to literacy class? And because they're working maybe a lower paid job, it's often a job where they don't find their schedule out until the Sunday before, say if you're working at a restaurant or something like that. So having enough time to devote not only to showing up to class each week, but also to investing the time at home without interruption to work on your reading, your writing, your speaking, that's the biggest challenge for the average adult learner.
We've heard a lot of statistics and we've looked at the academic side of this issue, but what should we know about the people who struggle with literacy?
These are real people, and this could be someone at your church, someone within your office, or your neighbor next door. It's not always apparent that someone doesn't have the literacy skills needed. We don't really use the term illiteracy anymore because it's not often that someone will come in with zero writing or reading skills. Most people come in with a foundation. They're just low literate. But that means that when they're trying to do everyday activities like read their mail or fill out a form, that they're not fully understanding what they're being asked to do, and then there's a lot of miscommunications along the way. These people may also be masters at hiding this big secret. They forgot their glasses. They have a headache today, so they're always asking for help from other people, and I think that's the number one reason why someone asks for help is because they're tired of asking for other people to help them. They don't want people to know. They want to be able to do all these things on their own, especially when it comes to medical forms and some of that private information.
When you think back to the people you've worked with, can you think of a time when you've witnessed a direct impact your work has had on a person or on a family?
I have a lot of different examples, but I think our family literacy program is my favorite program that we have. We partner with Head Start. Head Start is the expert in early childhood education. They teach the children. We're the experts in adult literacy education. We teach the adults. But then we come together every month for a family activity night, and we teach the parents how to incorporate family literacy activities into the home, and they do some sort of a make-and-take activity and get a book to take home. And that's the program where I see the greatest gains because the parents are learning, the children are watching the parents value education and make time for the family, and then we're showing that the children whose parents are involved in the literacy instruction are making greater gains in the literacy areas compared to a control group. So it's a win-win for everyone in the entire family. And not only are they all learning, other things are happening in their life. The parents are getting jobs. The children are doing better in school. All sorts of things are happening. The parents are volunteering in the Head Start classroom when they weren't before. So it's really exciting to see all that happen.
How do you hope attitudes, public attitudes about literacy will change?
My hope is that everyone realize that literacy is the key to a lot of the problems. So if your passion is healthcare, people that are more literate are going to be more healthy. If your passion is poverty, people that are more literate are going to be out of poverty in a more efficient rate. So whatever it is that you have a passion for, I'm sure that literacy touches that in some way. And as families and adults improve their literacy, they're going to be able to better navigate the system and help our economy as a whole.
and for the individuals and the families you work with? What do you hope for them ultimately?
I hope that they can be proud of themselves and see themselves as not only learners, but as competent members of society and equals to someone who may be more literate than them, and just be proud that they are taking control of any problem that they might have and doing the right thing to get their family on the right track.
Angela Steele is the director of the Adult Tutoring Program at the Literacy Center of West Michigan. Since the founding of the United States, immigrants have played a role in creating communities. And in some Midwestern cities, they're responsible for reinvigorating former manufacturing towns. In Buffalo, New York, for example, more than 1,000 refugees arrive every year. They are helping revive the shrinking Rust Belt city after a half century of decline. And literacy is seen as many refugees' best chance to contribute to their new home and become successful in America. For Front and Center, Daniel Robinson brings us this story from Buffalo.
Abby Hussein sits in a cramped classroom full of old metal chairs that clank and scrape the faded tile floor.
No dictionary. No dictionary.
Here they learn idioms like don't judge a book by its cover and how to order adjectives.
But you're just going to make a nice simple sentence, okay? English is a blank, blank, blank language, right?
This is a long way from Somalia, where Hussein struggled to find food and lived in constant fear of being dragged into the country's ongoing civil war.
It's kind of horrible things. People kill each other. So that's why we get help to get in here. People call us a refugee.
Now Hussein lives in a growing Somali community in a poor area of Buffalo. Aging, inexpensive housing has proven fertile ground for ethnic neighborhoods made up largely of refugees. While at home and around friends, Hussein says he's tempted to speak his native Somali language, but he was told learning English will help him find a job in America.
English is not my language. It's kind of difficult to speak and to read and to understand the words, but I study hard.
During class, Hussein is clustered in a room with 24 other refugees from Ghana, Iraq, Burma, and Afghanistan. Most refugees are enrolled within 72 hours of arrival. Each student knows a different language or dialect. Teacher Nick Prin instructs his class to speak as a group. He says it's the best way to make the most progress with the most students.
You got to speak first, and then the reading and the writing is a secondary concern. It kind of hurts to put them on the back burner, but if you think about if you go to another country, the first thing you need to do is speak.
For most refugees, classrooms are an entirely new concept. Many have never used electricity, a phone, or a pencil before. They start at the very beginning, learning by tracing the alphabet. Anne Britton is with Catholic Charities of Buffalo, which offers 10 levels of English classes.
You know, we're not looking for people to quote Shakespeare. We're looking for people to know what the difference is between hot and cold and slow down, go faster. I mean, very basic life skills and employment skills that they need.
Amy Lawrence works for Literacy Volunteers of Buffalo. She says at a certain point, refugees would rather spend time looking for work or earning an income than sitting in class. Refugees are responsible for paying for their plane tickets to the U.S., so most are immediately in debt. And Lawrence says English classes don't pay the bills.
They want the jobs now. They want the skills now. They don't want to wait a couple years. You know, and many of them have families they have to start providing right now.
In essence, that's what local leaders want from refugees, to help the local economy by getting jobs and building a new tax base. Most settle for work in restaurants and hotels that don't require fluency in English. Government officials say refugees are also in high demand at local companies. But with Buffalo's cheap rent and low cost of living, some opt to start their own businesses. Luis Sano plays a carimba, a popular instrument she sells in her shop, Global Villages. She has colorful baskets, handmade jewelry, and painted ostrich eggs as big as footballs.
Right now, I have products from Rwanda, which is my native country, and then South Africa, Swaziland, Zimbabwe, and I have products from Kenya.
Sano came to Buffalo in 2007 as a refugee. She received business training from a local nonprofit and eventually a microloan. Her shop started as just a table among many and a flea market-like store for small refugee businesses.
The community show us, you know what, yes, you are a refugee, but that's a status. It's not like a state of mind. It's not like you you cannot think or you cannot do this, you can. So if you are told you can, you can.
Now with a growing customer base, Sano is expanding into a larger space. She plans to hire fellow refugees to work in the store, which she hopes will help them learn English. She's also eager to help them write business plans and eventually open their own shops here in Buffalo. For Front and Center, I'm Daniel Robison in Buffalo, New York.
It's Front and Center. Until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, literacy tests were used to prevent some people, largely African Americans, from voting. Joining us to take a look at the history of literacy and democracy is Jane Daly, Associate Professor of American History at the University of Chicago. Professor Daly, welcome.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit more about how literacy tests were used, especially in the South, to prevent people from voting.
Literacy tests were a late 19th century innovation in the post-Civil War South, and they were explicitly designed to restrict the suffrage and particularly to reduce the number of black men who could vote.
What would these tests typically contain?
Well, it depends. It was the discretion was very much left to local officials. So sometimes they would ask you to read a portion of the state constitution. Sometimes they would ask you to read the Bible. Sometimes they would ask you to read the names on a list. And the way that it worked for black voters was that it didn't matter if they could read or not read. The registrar always said that they couldn't and then denied them the vote.
Do we know how literacy affects how and whether people vote today?
The way that it works today, we don't have literacy tests today, but we do have the secret ballot. And the secret ballot was a less obvious way of restricting the suffrage through literacy. Because when you go into the ballot booth, you're there all by yourself. And you have to know how to read, and you have to read the ballot. You can get confused. And today, we can bring people in with us into the booth to help us if we want. But that was not the case at the turn of the 20th century when the secret ballot was adopted across the United States. So one way that the secret ballot restricts suffrage is people don't like to admit that they can't read. So people who couldn't read basically just stopped going to the polls.
So when we think about literacy and how it was used as a test in the past, do we see that still happening maybe but taking a different shape now?
Well, any impediments to the vote are going to affect, usually adversely, the ability of people to go and participate in democracy. So, as I say, the secret ballot is a disincentive for people who are illiterate. Special elections are a disincentive. You have to know if you have an off-season election, then you don't necessarily know what's going to happen. If you can't read, you can't read the political signs. You can hear things on the radio and you can hear things on television. But it's hard, I think, to be an engaged citizen if you're lacking basic literacy skills.
So what does it mean for our society if we have a portion of the population that isn't literate, that isn't able to fully advocate for themselves and thus fully participate in the democracy?
Well, there's a cascade effect, because if you can't vote, you can't elect people who are going to represent your interests. If you don't have people representing your interests, then you don't have any influence over policy decisions or new laws that are written, and so you're left out of the conversation.
Some people might say, if you can't read the ballot, if you can't read an article on a political issue, that's your responsibility, that's your fault. But how much of the responsibility lies with society in making sure that people are included in democracy?
Well, there's no particularly good reason why you have to be literate to vote. This is one of the reasons why literacy tests were so effective at limiting the vote, because until the modern era, most people weren't literate, and many people participated in democracy without being literate. In the 18th century, you had a property qualification, and it didn't matter if you were literate or not. If you had $300 worth of property, you could vote if you were a man, if you're a white man. So this idea that one has to be literate in order to be informed is not necessarily correct.
We know that low literacy rates are more concentrated in low-income communities. If people in those areas are limited in their ability to self-advocate, how does it impact those communities?
Well, I think it affects them adversely. Again, if you can't participate in electoral politics, then you can't get resources directed to your community. And if you don't have resources, if you don't have public school funds, if you don't have a voice on the school board, if you don't have representation at every level, from the municipal level straight on up to the state level and the federal level, then your capacity to advocate for your community is just dramatically curtailed.
We've been speaking with Associate Professor of American History at the University of Chicago, Jane Daly. Professor Daly, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, reading once meant opening the pages of a newspaper or a book.
Now we get information just flowing in all different forms, different kinds of tweets, different text messages, all sorts of ways that people can send information.
We'll explore the future of literacy in an ever-changing digital age. That's in about 15 minutes on Front and Center from Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is Front and Center. I'm Jen White.
My name is Patricia Polacco. I write and illustrate children's picture books. In my family, one of the traditions they do when you're about four, the family puts a book in front of you and they drizzle honey on the cover of the book. And they ask the child to taste the honey, and when you do, they'll say, well, what does this taste like? And the answer is, this is sweet. And then the family says, yes, and so is knowledge. So for me, the promise of reading, I mean, my God, I knew that was the world. There it was. The learning disabilities that I have dyslexia, dysnumeria, dysgraphia, and failure of sensory integration. I have to say, truly, I could not read until I was 14. Along with that journey of not being able to read also came a bitter, horrible pill of I believed I was dumb. My nightmare when I was a kid was being asked to read in front of my class, and I would start shaking, my knees would give way, my heart would pound so fast, I was sure the kids in the back row could hear it. I'd hang onto the book so tight it broke my fingernails. So here I am at Willard Junior High, and Mr. Felker came bouncing through the door. He must have suspected what was going on. One day he asked me to stay after school to wash blackboards, and he came up behind me and asked me to make letters and numbers on that board. I then realized here is the person that I wanted to love me more than anything, and now he knew that I was stupid. But he sank to a knee next to me and said, Tricia, I think I know something about you. And I wailed. And I said, Mr. Felker, I'm dumb. He says, listen, if you have fooled us to your 14th year, you're not dumb. He says, I do think you have something that has a name. He says, now, I don't know how to find it. He said, but I have a friend who might be able to help us. Out of his own pocket, I'm sure, he paid for Miss Plessy to work with me. I do remember the day when Miss Plessy and Mr. Felker and I were having our lesson, and they put text in front of me. And for the first time in my life, I could look at text, get a mental image. Something came out of my mouth that was exactly the same thing that was on that page. Honest to God, I will never forget that moment. It's called the aha moment. And I remember literally dropping the book and thanking them both and running all the way home. Ran into the kitchen, jumped up on the counter, grabbed a jar of honey, found a book, poured the honey on the cover, and I knew my life had changed.
Patricia Polacco is a Michigan-based children's book author and illustrator. Now, usually when you hear the word literacy, you think of reading and writing, but a new form of literacy is becoming increasingly important, digital literacy. Front and Center's Shannon Heffernan has this story about one bridge in the digital divide.
A cheery older man carrying a huge bag overflowing with papers sits in Chicago's Harold Washington Library.
My name is Charlie Brown. How are you?
Brown describes himself as computer illiterate. And he's here to meet with Zach McMahon, a cyber navigator.
And that's a double click there. Remember the cadence for that? Real quick. There you go.
McMahon is one of 45 part-time cyber navigators at some Chicago libraries. Their positions are all grant-funded. They help patrons learn to use computers. But as more social services and jobs move online, these employees are almost like digital social workers.
I use it to try to find a job, try to find out what's available to a senior citizen, such as food pantries or clothing or housing assistance.
The cyber navigators don't type or fill out forms for people. They want them to learn to do it themselves.
2, 5. Sorry, I'm slow. Sometimes I just push it over to a baby. Log me in, please.
So when Brown pushes the keyboard towards McMahon because he's too frustrated with spelling.
Okay, put it down because you can spell those words. I can't spell. I'm sorry.
McMahon pushes the keyboard back to Brown, encouraging him to try.
Here.
So Brown pulls out a notebook full of handwritten words he regularly uses but can't spell.
All the words, my needed spelling words are right here.
The McMahon shows him the spell check, and Brown is relieved.
Right side of your mouse. All right. See, it's giving us spelling suggestions there.
Yep. Fix it for us.
Oh, okay.
Nice, huh?
A report from the American Library Association reveals that as social service agencies cut back on staff, they are sending people online. McMahon said he often gets people who've never used the internet but need to quickly access some social service. Harold Washington Library in downtown Chicago is very near a federal immigration office. McMahon says they send him a lot of referrals.
Last year sometime, an Italian gentleman came in, very little English skills, and he was looking to fill out his I-90 form.
That's a form for people who have lost their green card and need to travel.
His English was very minimal, and the immigration office hadn't sent him over with, you know, a note on his shirt saying, this is what I need. Unfortunately, we spent the first 15 minutes just trying to figure out, you know, what it was that this gentleman was trying to do. I think it was his brother's funeral, and that was why he needed to return to Italy. And so I sat down with him. He'd never touched a computer before. When he went to grab the mouse, the first thing he did was, you know, get up and raise it up above his head. And, you know, we got through it, and we got everything that he needed done. He left pretty happy, and he was going to be able to go home the next week for his brother's funeral.
According to the American Library Association, over half of libraries say helping patrons access government information is one of the most critical services they provide. But not everyone gets the help they need. Aaron Smith is with the Pew Internet and American Life Project. He says 1 in 5 Americans doesn't go online at all. They include people who access many government services.
They tend to be older. They tend to have relatively low levels of income, relatively low levels of education, people with a chronic health condition or some type of disability that makes it difficult for them, as well as language proficiency.
So far, most essential government forms are still available in hard copy, but some are only available by mail order and are processed much quicker online.
D16.
As for Mr. Charlie Brown, he says he'll visit the cyber navigators again next week.
3, 4, 2. What do you think your situation would be if you didn't have this services?
On the verge of being homeless, so I'd be sleeping underneath the bridge with the rest of the guys.
The text box there now.
Where'd it go?
You're all good now. I see the cursor.
For Front and Center, I'm Shannon Heffernan in Chicago.
We're joined now by Elizabeth Moji, Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Literacy, Language, and Culture in the School of Education at the University of Michigan. Professor Moji, welcome.
Thank you.
When we talk about literacy, people think about the ability to read. But how is our understanding of what it means to be literate shifting in the face of new technologies?
Well, there are many changes in technology that lead to changes in literacy, although some of those changes are more superficial than we might think. The way we think about literacy has been multimodal for years, throughout time, really. We've always used print, images, we've used multiple forms of representation to make meaning, to communicate with others. But when we think about literacy, especially in a digital age, we start to think about the ways that speed of access, amount of information, and reach. The audience we might connect with shifts and changes in a digital age. And that requires different kinds of skills in terms of literacy. It requires that we be more critical, more open to question, more challenging in our thinking about the meaning we're making from different kinds of texts.
So one of the changes as well in the digital age is how we're receiving the messages, right?
Now we get information just flowing in all different forms. So different kinds of tweets, different text messages might come into us. We have call-ins, we have open sourcing. We have all sorts of ways that people can send information. And so the reader, and I'm using that word loosely, the literate person has to be able to sort through all of those different forms of information and figure out which form, which source is credible. How do I make sense of this and take the information and share it with someone else? So that speed, the reach, and the amount of information all in an unedited or less edited environment really changes the way we think about being critical readers and writers and communicators.
How much of that ability to become a critical reader or writer, how much of that is connected to access to technology?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. It's interesting because it may be that the ability to be critical is actually fostered by having more information, by being able to, with a, you know, a click of a button, actually get another perspective, another way of thinking about the information. On the other hand, it may also be that we're more susceptible to many different views and perspectives, and so we can't sort as easily. We're overwhelmed with information. It may also be that we take small bites of information as truth and don't dig down into really understanding all of the different nuances of an issue. So on one hand, it may be that access makes us more critical, but on the other hand, we may start to hear, read bits of information and believe them because they're simply there and they're easy to access.
When we look at communities that are disproportionately affected by low literacy, what does it mean when you then introduce new technologies?
That question is a difficult one to answer because most communities now have some access to different kinds of technologies. It's really the quality of access and not the quantity of access that I think is the issue.
We've been asking people from around the region for their thoughts and questions about literacy. So let's bring Marcus into the conversation. His thoughts have to do with digital literacy and the economy.
For people who resist something as powerful as the internet, they will just be left behind. If you can't run Excel or Word, you pretty much can't get a job in most offices these days.
So as we look forward to how the job market is being shaped, how essential is a high level of digital literacy?
Having access to those tools and knowing how to use them, it's not just about access, of course, really matters in the 21st century. I use each of the tools he mentioned every day. I believe the people I work with use those tools. My daughter, my 14-year-old daughter, uses those tools. So I think that it's accurate to say that people will need access to those technologies. At the same time, I would say that most schools are teaching those technologies, those particular tools. The real question is how much access different groups of people have to even more sophisticated tools and how that might sort people into different categories of opportunity.
And now we're going to bring Matt into the conversation.
I think more and more public communication is moving to these digital platforms. There's an expectation that you can pay parking tickets or file your taxes or communicate with a company if you have a problem with their products all online. And if you don't have internet access or have never really learned to use a computer, are you getting left out of a large portion of our public dialogue?
When we look at how literacy is changing, does it impact people's ability to participate fully in society and democracy?
I think it does. I think that Matt's point about access to, again, more sophisticated tools. Text messaging is wonderful, but it's limited. It only allows you to write very short messages, or at least for me it does, because it tries my patience to try to, you know, type out with one finger all the words. So I think that question of sophisticated tools is critical. I do think that people who don't have access to those tools will risk being left out of the public discourse. And I do think that is the responsibility of public education, or all education. It is the responsibility of educators to provide access. Now, what I will say is that in my travels across multiple school districts, I do see people working to do that. But again, districts in more economically compromised settings have more of a challenge in doing that, because they simply can't get and maintain the hardware for enough students to really provide that on a daily basis. Again, though, I would say it's not really that different from 50 years ago or 100 years ago. The people, in fact, have greater access, greater ability to be heard than ever before, because we have all of these different forms of communication, even if they're short, even if they're 140 characters. People can make their voices heard, and they are making their voices heard in really powerful ways, and we see that all around the world.
When we look ahead, maybe 50 years, do you think we'll look at this as being a major turning point, a time when we really changed what literacy meant, or will this just be a little blip?
I am hopeful, and so I believe that this is a major turning point. I have been in education for 29 years, and I have been studying adolescent literacy in particular, with a focus on literacy across all the domains of young people's lives. And there has not been the kind of attention to continuing to support literacy development in my career. So this is a moment in time that I think represents a kind of sea change, a real focus on wanting to develop critical thinkers, critical readers and writers.
And is that happening because of new technologies? Is that a driving force behind it?
I think it's because, to some extent, because of new technologies. But I think it's also because, you know, it's sort of trite to say this, but our world is shrinking. We have greater access to communities across the world. We have to think differently about who we are as a country. We have to think differently about our environment, about the resources we're using. We need leaders. We are a changing population. We're an aging population. And we really need to have young people who can take us into the latter part of the 21st century and continue to build a strong, robust society. And I think that our commitment to really developing citizens is shifting and changing. I was just in Singapore, and the Singaporeans are talking about the need to build a society of concerned citizens. And I think that's what we're seeing here in the U.S. as well. And it's just a really exciting time, because there's the recognition that literacy, in all its manifestations, in all the different forms of media we might imagine, is really a key to developing that concerned and robust citizenry.
We've been joined by Elizabeth Moji, Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Literacy, Language, and Culture in the School of Education at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our show was produced for Front and Center at Michigan Radio by Zoe Clark, with help from Thea Card, Allie Billings, and Mercedes Mejia. Tamar Charney was the executive producer. Front and Center's senior project editor is Aurora Aguilar. Shannon Heffernan, producer. And Sally Isley is the executive producer. I'm Jen White.
Support for Front and Center comes from the Joyce Foundation, improving the quality of life in the Great Lakes region and across the country.